This is the 2009 Rogue River Bible School, Day 2. The first period speaker is Brother Ken Stiles, and his class subject is Studies in Esther. His class title for today is Esther Crowned. Brother Ken, please.
Thanks, Brother Robbie, and good morning, everyone. If you pull out your handout from yesterday, we just had one or two comments from chapter 1 before proceeding into chapter 2. We had covered yesterday Ahasuerus somewhat briefly and his character. Just wanted to bring your attention, if you open your Bible to chapter 1, don't recall whether or not we made the point that one of the reasons the king is portrayed the way he is in chapter 1 is so that when he selects Esther as his queen to replace Vashti in chapter 2, we have some understanding of who this king is. And it's important that we recognize the characteristics that are recorded and conveyed to us. So in verse 12 of chapter 1, the king is understandably enraged when the queen has refused to come to his feast. This was to be the height of the celebration of the feasts in chapter 1, and she picked that moment to convey publicly to all her unwillingness to reflect the king's glory and the glory of the empire. The king ends up enraged, and it's one thing to be of a sound, quiet, peaceful mind and be making the right decisions. But in this fit of enragement, notice that the king in verse 13 turns to the law and to the counselors. Then the king said, he's in a fit of rage in verse 12, and that is to boil with anger. He said to the wise men who knew the times, reading from the RSV, for this was the king's procedure or manner, as it is in the AV, toward all who were versed in law and judgment. So in his fit of anger, he turns to the law and he turns to the counselors as another indication of the character of this king. If you look on number 6, I believe it is in the handout, there's a couple of other points associated with him revealed later on in the book about the king's character. He's the type of person that Haman has to deceive. Because Haman knows that if he goes to the king in chapter 3 and presents the full scope of his plan, the king will probably not agree with it. So Haman has to deceive the king in order to have the Jews destroyed, which indicates the king would not have been in support of such a plan. We also read later in the book that Ahasuerus will seek to redress the wrong done by failing to honor Mordecai. In chapter 6, at that critical moment, his mind goes back to the fact that, you know, a man saved my life several years back. What did we ever do to honor him? Well, King, we did nothing. Well, we need to make up for that, because he was the kind of man who honored those who were loyal to him and had the presence of mind to call back to a much earlier event. He has a high regard for Persian law, so that when it's uncovered that he has put a law into effect to destroy these people, he doesn't just say, well, we will set that law aside and break it and pretend it was never made. He respects the law of his empire, and he says we can't obliterate that law, but we can pass a second law to, in effect, nullify the first law. He will come to value, as we'll see in chapter 2, and as I think we mentioned yesterday, the character of Esther, and he will come to value the character and judgment of Mordecai. You don't turn the ruling authority of your empire over to a man like Mordecai unless you have absolute trust and confidence and respect for the principles by which Mordecai lives. So again, we're not saying that Ahasuerus in the book is a God-fearing man. I wouldn't put him in the same category, for instance, as Nebuchadnezzar, as Brother Skip mentioned in his class yesterday. And the wonderful words that he writes in a spirit of great humility in chapter 4. But the way he is portrayed, this is King Ahasuerus. is that he is a benevolent ruler who always comes down in the book on the side of what is right and lawful and best for the empire, not best for himself. He and Haman are two entirely different characters, is portrayed in the book. Now, we should mention as well that we won't be going through all of the notes. One example of that is we've given you number 12, I believe, it on the handout, if you want to look afterwards. We were impressed in going through chapter 1 that the writer of the book of Esther has purposely written the events of chapter 1 as if he is seeing the future kingdom of God. Now, we're not saying that the feast of chapter 1 was a cameo of the future kingdom as how Ahasuerus had it designed. But spiritual men and women can look at events, and they can record those events and think upon those events in terms of the coming kingdom. And that's how the events of chapter 1 are portrayed. So if you go through, and we won't take the time today, there are multiple examples tying the feasts of chapter 1 with the future time when the world will be under the blessed reign of the Lord Jesus Christ and will be invited to participate, to share in the glory of the kingdom in that day. So don't be confused that somehow the king of Persia understood what the kingdom of God was like and was trying to pattern this feast after the kingdom of God. It's more a case of the writer of the events of chapter 1 are inviting us to see the similarities that were happening between the feast and the coming kingdom. And we need to see events in our life in that same way, so that it may not be the kingdom that we are experiencing in our mortality, but we're able to see the events in our life as a forerunner, as a foretaste. This week, for instance, being one, and how many of us in the past haven't spoken of the spiritual blessings of Bible schools, because it gives us a foretaste of what the kingdom will be like. Not that this is the kingdom this week, but it's a way we explain to our children that when we're immersed in a week-long period of time in which righteousness is the prevailing spirit and culture, this is what it will be like to live in God's kingdom. We concluded yesterday with making the observation that Vashti had made character the principal element at play, so to speak, in chapter 1 and now in chapter 2. In fact, what we'll find throughout the book of Esther is it emphasizes the character of each of the major individuals portrayed. Neither Esther or Mordecai, again, have power to interpret dreams. They can't impress the Gentile king like Joseph could or like Daniel could. There will be no open miracles which permit them to emerge from a fiery furnace, and it's become quite obvious that they are special individuals. It isn't the special powers they possess that impress the king, it's their character. It will first be Esther, and then we'll see later on, it will be Mordecai. And the result of their character is what causes the king to elevate them. So as we said yesterday, the focus of chapter 1 was on character, so when we come to chapter 2, young ladies and mothers of young ladies make special note of the need to get below the surface of these stories. If we read chapter 2 and all we see is a Miss Universe contest, and Esther wins the contest because she is the most beautiful of all the beautiful women, we do Esther, we do this book, we do the work of Mordecai, we do our Heavenly Father a great disservice. Esther is not winning a Miss Universe contest in chapter 2. She is in competition, so to speak, with a house full of the most beautiful women that stretch from the Grecian islands all the way to the country of India today. Because when the law goes forth that all of these beautiful young maidens are to be gathered in, there would have been a houseful of the most gorgeous young ladies to be seen across the empire. And she is not the most beautiful. That is not why the king selects her. It's because of her character. And we'll go through and see the evidence. It's her character that dominates the chapter. Because what we find is that she is an obedient, modest, quiet, gentle, young Jewish maiden. And there are lessons here, not just for the young ladies and the sisters, but for the brethren as well. Because remember, as we said yesterday, she represents spiritual Israel. Those who come to understand who the true enemy in life is and stand up to him. So the steps she takes are the steps that we need to take. And we need to realize that on a practical standpoint, it's very helpful, especially for the young ladies that are in the teen class this week, to be able to see the steps that Esther took as a young lady in a Gentile-dominated society. It's important for them to understand the steps she took because she can become a role model for the young ladies and the young sisters among us. Her faithfulness in the time of crisis is second to none in Scripture because she comes to the point where she's willing to put her life on the line to save her people. She will come to learn of the need to put the needs of the ecclesia above her own. And she will initially be reluctant to take that step, but she will make that step in a decision that is made by faith. So the wonderful character of Esther all evaporates if all we see is an extremely beautiful young Hebrew maiden who happened to strike the fancy of the king of Persia. The proof of it, the proof that it is her character and not her beauty. First of all, in verse 7, we say up front that she was stunningly beautiful. He, being Mordecai, had brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, the daughter of his uncle, for she had neither father nor mother. The maiden was beautiful and lovely, or fair and beautiful, I think it is in the AV. And when her father and her mother died, Mordecai took her or adopted her as his own daughter. If you trace through those Hebrew words, it puts Esther in the same category as Sarah and Rebecca and Abigail and Rachel and Bathsheba and Vashti. She was an extremely beautiful young woman. But her beauty was a prerequisite for her initial selection into the house of the women. It's her character that won her the crown. She is obedient to Mordecai in verse 10. And she is obedient to Mordecai in verse 20. Verse 10 occurs when she goes into the house of the women. She did not make known her people or her kindred, for Mordecai had charged her not to make it known. 12 plus months later in verse 20, when she is now established as the queen of the empire, she is still obeying Mordecai. Because the events of those 12 months had not changed her willingness to obey her uncle, sorry, her cousin, who had become like unto her as a father. She's in the palace gate, sorry, he's in the palace gate in verse 10, and she now becomes the queen in verse 20, and she continues to obey him. But notice who Esther impresses in this chapter. The first person she impresses is Haggai, the chamberlain of the king's servants, the one who had the responsibility for the house of women. Immediately upon seeing her, he is impressed with her. In verse 9, we read, "And the maiden pleased him." This is Haggai, "and won his favor," or kindness as it is in the AV, "and he quickly promoted her with her ointments and her portions of food and with seven chosen maidens from the king's palace and advanced her or preferenced her and her maids to the best place in the harem or the house of the women." So immediately upon seeing Esther, Haggai recognizes that she is the one that stands out above everyone else, and he gives her the ointments and the things such as food and the seven chosen maids from the king's palace, and he gives her the best place in the house of the women. And the word, therefore, speedily in verse 9, as it is in the AV, is to be suddenly alarmed or agitated, to hasten anxiously. He was in a hurry. He began barking orders. "I want special treatment for this one right here." and special treatment is given to Esther. He's a chamberlain, brethren and sisters. The AV softens it. He's a eunuch. Her physical beauty is beyond him. He's surrounded by a house full of beautiful women. It's not her beauty that won over Haggai. See, he has the responsibility to find a wife for the king. Because if too much time goes by and he's not able to find a wife for the king, who do you think's going to be responsible? You mean to tell me, Haggai, in this whole empire, we can't find one young lady that can be the queen? So he has that as his foremost responsibility. And he probably has some idea of what the king will find to be of significance. He probably has some idea of who or what type of woman the king will be looking for, especially in light of the fact that the prior queen brought such shame and dishonor to the throne. But right off the bat, not unlike Joseph, when people saw Joseph immediately, yes, he was handsome and good-looking, but it wasn't his good looks that endeared him immediately to the people he came in contact with. There was something different about Joseph, as we know, and there was something different about this young Hebrew maiden by the name of Hadassah or Esther. In this house full of beautiful women, she immediately stands out. What's most remarkable is in verse 15. The second group of people in which Esther stands out are the other women in the house of women. When the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had adopted her as his own daughter, to go into the king, she asked for nothing except what Haggai, the king's eunuch, who had charge of the women, advised. Now Esther found favor in the eyes of all who saw her. And you look up that word saw in vines, and it means to observe, to perceive, to get acquainted with, to gain an understanding of. Imagine the atmosphere in the house of the women. Here's how it works. You get 12 months of purification, and then you get one shot, one chance, one opportunity. And if the king selects you, you become queen of the world. And if he rejects you, you go to the house of condemnation, to die childless, to die husbandless. Now, what kind of atmosphere do you think would have existed in the house of the women? With all of the purifications taking place, it's a do or die proposition. And yet Esther has the kind of character in which all who saw her, all who got to know her, all who became acquainted with her, she found favor in their sight. How is it possible for any woman in that surrounding to gain favor in the eyes of all the other women? Unless there was one woman in that group who put the interests of others ahead of her own, and who became a resource to the rest of the women, not a threat, because that's what the mind of Christ does. It puts the interests of others ahead of one's own. And whatever happened in the house of the women, the rest of the women saw something special about Esther. The Hebrew word for grace is the word chen, and it's used interchangeably with favor, because in verse 15, she found favor in the eyes of the women. In verse 17, she will find grace in the eyes of the king. So she must have had the kind of character that allowed her to rise above the rest of the fray. And she was unfazed by the stress of the situation. This is the kind of young woman she was. She's in a house filled with beautiful young women, and this single young Jewish maiden stood above them all. And the lesson for all of us, brethren and sisters, sisters as well as brethren, is the truth will distinguish us from others if we live by its principles, even in the eyes of the Gentiles, even in the eyes of those in such a situation in which she was in. What she took with her when she went in to see the king was something that none of the other women could take with them, and that was a godly character. Because Haggai had recognized that it was her character that is what she needed to take into the king, a character that had been molded by the divine principles under which Mordecai had raised her. So that by the time we come to verse 17, when the king finally determines that she will be the queen, the king in chapter 2 is the last one to realize this is going to be my queen. Reading in verse 17, the king loved Esther more than all the women, and she found grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. So even with him, it was her character that distinguished her. You don't show grace and favor to a woman who is simply stunningly beautiful and that's all she has. But you do show grace and favor to an individual that has a character that distinguishes her from all others. In verse 14, the king was to select the woman in whom he delighted. And it's the same word used to describe the king's high regard for Mordecai later on in chapter 6. So again, the record is drawing our attention to her character. Vashti had made character the issue in chapter 1, and Esther will now find grace and favor, chen and kesed, in the eyes of the king. Kesed being the equivalent of agape love in the New Testament. So it's her character that impressed the king. So that's 3 out of 3. She impressed Haggai with her character. She impressed the other women in the house of women with her character. And she impressed the king with her character. And this is why we say she's such a marvelous example for young ladies and young sisters. She's likely only 20 years old and already has a godly character that sets her apart from all the other Gentiles around her. And Esther's example is why God asks sisters, wives in particular, to strive for a quiet, gentle spirit. It has to do with the nature of husbands, as we know. God has given husbands specific characteristics that will enable them to properly guide a household and help govern the ecclesia. But those same characteristics that are important in leadership, if they are used inappropriately, can lead to anger and pride, the inability to admit our mistakes. They can lead to arrogance, always wanting to be right. They can lead to vengefulness. Those same leadership characteristics that, if used improperly, can so easily lead to sin are the characteristics that are so greatly aided by an influence in the home that is a quiet, gentle spirit. And that's why Ahasuerus was likely able to see the benefit that Esther would bring to the throne. And that's also why, brethren, God places such a high value on those qualities of having a quiet, gentle spirit. And it's why God, as we know, made women the way he did. She is the perfect mate for the characteristics that he built into man's constitution. And this is why, husbands, we want to do all we can to encourage this quiet, gentle spirit in our wives. It's what we need to counteract the pressures of work and the pressures of ecclesial life and raising children and teenagers, especially sometimes at the pressures that can overwhelm us. It's a wonderful spiritual resource to have in our home, to draw upon, to be counseled by. Brethren, we want to kindle that spirit. We want to encourage that spirit. The last thing we want to do is to kill that spirit because of its beneficial effect on us. Now take note that Esther does not change her behavior for the king. She maintains the identical character with the king that she had when she first entered the house of the women. It's an important night when Esther goes in and takes her turn to be with the king. And the lesson for us is that when we have important events in our life, whether they're to do with our work, whether they're to do with our ecclesial life, whatever the situation may be, that is not the time to abandon the principles of the truth. That is not the time to abandon our spiritual character and try to adopt a new one. It's the time for the principles of the truth to radiate throughout our character. And what's even more remarkable is that not only did she retain her character when she went into the king, but think about what's happened in the life of Esther for the last 12 months. Sisters especially, imagine spending 12 months' time in a royal health spa. Every imaginable pampered opportunity is at your fingertips. And you have 7 women whose responsibility is solely to make sure you are well catered to, and that your pampering couldn't be any higher than it already is. Every possible preferential treatment and accommodation will be made known, or be made available to you. Every known beauty treatment, mud pack, lotion, pedicure, manicure, whatever it is, it's all at your disposal as often as you want it. Because the whole purpose of this is to prepare you to go into the king. Prior to your selection, when you were living in Shushan, you were a nobody. You cleaned the house and washed the dishes and did the laundry for your cousin who has become your father. And that's all your life consisted of. And now, you're in this incredible environment. Brothers and sisters, her character didn't change despite all of that. And the reason we know that is because when she walks into the house of women, she is immediately respected in the eyes of Haggai because of her character. And 12 months later, when she goes into the king, she is selected by the king because of her character. So for 12 months, she's had available to her all of the beauty treatments known to man and all of the pampering available to women, and it hasn't changed her character. That is a remarkable young Hebrew maiden that God has selected for this role. She doesn't live for the present. She didn't live to be the queen of Persia. She was living her life to be part of a future kingdom. That's the only way your character can be subject to that kind of circumstance and not change. To be a house servant, so to speak, or a maiden in Mordecai's house on one day, and after 12 months of living in the house of women, be the exact same person. And what we'll find when we come to chapter 5 is 7 years later, when she goes in before the king, or 5 years, I believe it is, her character hasn't changed then either. So you see, God didn't make a mistake when he selected this young maiden to go into the house of women and potentially be the future queen. Verse 15 is written to underscore who it was that went into the king. She was still the daughter of Abihail, raised by Mordecai. She took her heritage and her upbringing with her. You see, the faithful remnant living in Gentile times in which we are surrounded by a Gentile influence, the faithful remnant does not allow their circumstances to change their character. Whether the circumstances are favorable, whether the circumstances include suffering, it doesn't matter. The faithful remnant does not permit their circumstances to change their character. So hopefully we're beginning to see that the real beauty of Esther is not her outward beauty. It was her spiritual character. And the fact or the truth of the matter is that it was God who selected this special young woman to sit on the throne in Persia. She had won over the hearts of all who had come to know her, including the king. And it wasn't her natural beauty that resulted in that. And that's why we need to stress with our young ladies especially, in this day and age in which the outward beauty is so fervently emphasized to the point of distorting the minds of our young sisters and our young ladies, it is not the outward beauty. It was very appropriate that God use a most beautiful woman to show us that exact lesson. So he takes a young woman who is stunningly beautiful and puts her through this treatment to show us that it was her character, not her beauty, that won her over to those around her. Husbands, again, we can learn a thing or two from Ahasuerus in his response to finding Esther. He was elated to find a woman like Esther with such qualities that she had. And as we know, as a result, he holds a feast in her honor, and he suspends the taxes, and he gives gifts liberally. He wanted all to know, I have found the most remarkable woman. You won't believe what she is like. And husbands, this was a Gentile king. How high should we hold our wives in esteem? When we understand and appreciate the spiritual value that they can bring into our lives, we ought to be thanking God daily if we have a wife in the truth in that situation for the wonder and the beauty that she brings into our life. Each of us know, myself included, where I would be without the wife that God has given to me. And if this Gentile king can show that kind of appreciation for Esther, it's an example for each of us in terms of our elation over the privilege that we have having the wife that we do. Now, we won't spend time in today's class identifying why Mordecai instructs Esther not to make known her people. There's information in the notes. It's not a case of Mordecai being afraid that somehow that would ruin his plan. Remember the contemporaries of Daniel that Brother Skip covered in his class yesterday. We are dealing with the Persian court. We know from Daniel 6 that there is a high level of anti-Semitism that exists in the Persian court. We know later on in Esther that there will be 75,000 people slain who were anti-Semitic, and that the Jews went out and destroyed. So when you put that information together, what Mordecai realized, what this is an issue of timing. There will come a time, Esther, when you need to make known who you are, but don't do it now, because you will be extremely vulnerable in that kind of an environment. We now turn our attention to Mordecai's character. Recall, it's the character of these individuals that God is impressing upon us in the way the book of Esther is written. We know from verse 6 of chapter 2 that we mentioned yesterday, he left Israel in the second captivity with Jehoiachin. We know from Jeremiah 24, as we read yesterday, that he was part of the good figs that were taken into captivity. We know from Romans 8, verse 28, that all things work together for good to those who love God and are called by him. But good figs still need to learn to trust God. And they need to learn to act consistent with that trust by obeying him. So that Mordecai becomes for us an example of what a good fig looks like coming out of captivity. He was a good fig going into captivity because verse 6 tells us that he was taken into captivity. And now we're coming up to the end of captivity and we see what a good fig looks like having lived in the captivity of the Babylonians and the Persians. He is an example of what walking by faith looks like. Good figs don't have their faith destroyed by captivity. The captivity actually develops their faith. So they are stronger individuals as a result of the captivity than they were at the beginning. And the reason being is that they have remained faithful to God, which is why we see Hananiah and Mishael and Azariah strengthened in their faith in their captivity despite the trying circumstances that God brought into their life. They are not afraid to publicly stand up for what they know to be true, even if the man they're standing up to and opposing happens to be the prime minister, as was the case with Mordecai. You know, he doesn't know what will become of Esther when she goes into the house of women. There's no angel that visits him in chapter 2 and says, now look, here is God's plan. She will be in there for 12 months, and then she will go in before the king, and she will be selected as queen, and then everything will work out. So I'm going to give you a show, or an indication, Mordecai, of what chapter 10 looks like in this book. He doesn't have any advance assurance of any kind, because he is a man walking by faith. And he has learned to trust God and commit his situation into God's hands. Now, what does walking by faith look like in these kinds of circumstances? Well, what it means is that you go to the court of women every single day. That's what walking by faith looks like. Even though you know that your trip to the court of the house of women will not resolve the situation. He cannot talk to Esther. In fact, if he has told her not to reveal her identity, surely he is not revealing his identity and his relationship to Esther. But he goes nonetheless, because what's happening in that house is of great importance to him, and he wanted to be nowhere else. Imagine the prayers of Mordecai as Esther sits in that house during the time of purification, not knowing what's to become of her. No prayer is recorded in the book of Esther. You cannot imagine, can you not imagine the prayers of that man who was going daily to the court of the women to see how she fared? Remember, he's at least 85 to 90 years old, and he makes this trip every day. He hasn't retired from his work in the truth. In fact, he is at work, not in the office or the factory, but he is at work in God's vineyard on a daily basis, doing what he can to help save others. Later on in the book, we find that Mordecai's most important work in his life will come at the very end of his life when he is made prime minister over the empire. So the truth is not something we retire from, as we know. It's something that grows to fill our daily life. Serving others and working on their behalf is something that comes as the focal point of all that we do. Imagine the impact of Mordecai's daily visits to the court of women. And no, this isn't recorded in the book of Esther, but all we need to do is place ourselves in that situation. Word would come to Esther, you know, there's an old man that comes to the court of the women every day, asks about how you're doing. And every day we tell him the same thing, she's doing fine. And the next day he comes back and he asks the very same question about how you're doing. Now, Esther hears this report. Who wouldn't be encouraged to learn that I have been taken and put in this house of women, and my father comes every day to find out how I'm doing? And you see, brothers and sisters, this is why we don't retire from the truth. Because we are to consume ourselves, not with our own salvation, but in saving others. And when others hear that we are devoting ourselves to their salvation, we can't fix their problems. We can't bring a cure to their body. We can't resolve the situations in their family. But surely we can bring some comfort and hope in their life by them knowing that we have that level of devotion to their spiritual well-being. And that's exactly what our older brothers and sisters can be doing for the younger members in the ecclesia, especially the younger members that have all these lovely little children running about. Those children that wake up at 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning. So the rest of us were sleeping, and some of the parents last night were up for maybe several hours trying to figure out, now how can I at least get a couple hours of sleep so I can maybe hear one or two points in the classes tomorrow that will be helpful. But that's the kind of involvement the older ones can bring, helpful involvement into the lives of the other ones. And Mordecai is portrayed as a faithful servant in all that he does. When Abihail and his wife die, Mordecai takes Hadassah into his home. Not because he says, you know what, Hadassah? You're going to be the future queen of Persia. So somebody needs to raise you to prepare you for that day. He has no idea what's coming in Esther's future. All he knows is that the law of Moses stipulates that when the parents die, the next of kin is responsible for the upbringing of that young girl. And he takes her into his house as a result of his faithful obedience to the law of Moses. So in verse 7, it says that she was brought up, or as the margin has, she was nourished. And he treated her as his own child and cares for her and teaches her about God and raises her as his own daughter. That's what walking by faith looks like. When you see a situation develop over which you had no control, you step forward in the love of Christ to give what you can give and to do for others as they need your doing for them, loving those in need and doing the right thing. We know again from his character that when he's sitting in the king's gate after Esther is made queen, he hears of the potential threat on the king's life. And he reports the matter to the king through Esther. And when he saves the king's life, he doesn't then go back through Esther and say, and what about the reward for saving your life? Because faithful men and women aren't looking for a reward in this life. They're looking to do the right thing, and they leave the matter with God. Mordecai has no idea how God will use this situation in chapter 2 to eventually save his life in chapter 6. But the faithful do what is right and leave the matter in God's hands. He was also an example of an outstanding parent and a father. A role model for all of us who are parents. We've already seen the level of care and concern that he had for Esther in the house of women. Parents, surely we are praying for our children every day, as Mordecai was praying for his daughter. And you see, here's where the principles of the truth diverge dramatically from the principles of the world. You talk to those in the world and they look forward to the day when their children move out of the house, because then they're on their own. That principle did not exist in the mind of Mordecai. He will not force Esther to do anything once she moves out of his house but he will very much remain involved in her life. Not to try to govern her life and dictate her life and tell her what to do and what not to do, but to remain involved in her life from a spiritual standpoint, to bring help and encouragement to her. Mordecai did not leave Esther to fend for herself. And you notice the relationship that the two of them had. Esther is still listening to the counsel of Mordecai after she moves out of his house. Esther is still listening to the counsel of Mordecai when she is queen of the world. Now, that didn't come about because Mordecai had forced her to obey him. That came about because during the time that they had a relationship together as father and daughter, Mordecai taught Esther to trust God and to live your life by the principles of God. So when she moves out of the house and has now become queen of the world, she is still seeking out that counsel because she had come to value that counsel in her life. Children, take note. The children in this room, take note. Esther will far advance her father, her uncle, her cousin, sorry, Mordecai, in what she attains in this life. Or at least she has in chapter 2. But she hasn't lost the ability to respect the counsel of her father, regardless of how high she was raised, so to speak, in the Gentile community. Most children will probably advance where their parents were. Not all do, but oftentimes that's the case. But children, spiritual children, no matter what their age, never lose sight of the value that their parents bring to their life. You know, Mordecai never taught Esther how to be a queen, but he did teach her to learn to walk by faith. And brethren and sisters, that's what we need to teach our children to do, so that before the day comes when they move out of our house for the last time, we have taught them how to examine a situation. And before we act to first determine what are the spiritual principles that govern this situation, and then teach them of the need to act consistent with those spiritual principles. Because if we can teach them that skill, and it is a skill, then when they find themselves in situations down the road, where whether it's great crises they face in their life, or whether that they become the queen of Persia, they have been prepared to deal with whatever circumstances may come in their life. We know they're going to have trials, and we know they are going to have faith-threatening trials, because all of us have had those, and that's how God develops his sons and daughters. And we need to teach them, even though we don't know what those trials specifically will be, how to respond to those trials. We'll close with the hand of providence at work in chapter 2. In verse 7, we say it's a learned skill, this ability to walk by faith. In verse 7, it says, Esther's parents die and she was taken. It's a tragedy when her parents die and she's left as an orphan. And as a result of that tragedy, there is a necessity in God's plan that he is working out, because he will now prepare her to grow up in Mordecai's house, because God knows she's eventually going to be a queen who will be asked to lay down her life to save her people. But the point we want to recognize is that there is a tragedy that occurs in verse 7. And as a result of the tragedy that is painful, there is a necessity that God is working out in her life. In verse 8, she is again taken. Now the Hebrew word, or the AV there, is brought into the house of the women. It's the same Hebrew word. She was taken. It's a tragedy. It would be tragic if somebody drove up in a van today and took any of the young ladies in that teen class and said, she is going off to become the future wife, potentially, of another man. That would be tragic. But it was also necessary in God's plan. So in each case, she is taken. She didn't send in a resume to be Queen of Persia. She was taken. They had no control. But that tragedy was a necessity in God's plan. In verse 16, she will once again be taken unto the king. And she will rise to a preeminent position. All necessary to prepare her to be placed in God's plan as the queen of Persia. So three times in this chapter she is taken. And three times she responds faithfully to that situation. And because she responds faithfully, God is able to work out a marvelous outcome for both her and for his people.